Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 7th of May. Coming up on the program, more on the George building collapse as the death toll rises overnight. A jobs wipeout looming at the post office, South Africa's international relations DG on the escalating crisis in Rafah, the legal dangers of taking a false sick day, and a major coffee accolade for Cape Town. Overnight, the death toll in the collapse of a five-story building near under construction along Victoria Street in George in the Western Cape has risen to five. We understand that scores of people are still trapped in the rubble. We're going to talk to the spokesperson for the MEC responsible for disaster management in just a moment. But firstly, let's hear from the Provincial Premier, Alan Windey, who was addressing a briefing a short time ago.
People's already started to clear space, depend patients from trauma units, etc. So they've been ready. So it's not just one, it's a number of hospitals in the region. What I also have is, obviously, so we've already got hospitals in the region, but dedicated to this specific case. There are three specialist doctors dedicated to it. Dr. Wayne Smith, who's online in this meeting as well, can also answer any questions. Two other emergency medical registrars. We've got specialist rescue technicians, 15 from George and 17 from Cape Town, forensic pathology services, three managers and nine forensic pathology officers, specialized rescue vehicles, six of them on site. We also have counseling, social workers and psychologists on site, three psychologists and one counselor. Our education department has also made space in the education building, which is also right next to.
Voter Creel speaks for Anton Bradel, who is the MEC responsible for disaster management. Mr. Creel, welcome to you. What is the position now? I understand that rescue workers are communicating with as many as 11 people who are still under the rubble. Bring me up to speed.
Hi, Jeremy. Yes. That's correct. Our latest numbers indicate that there were 75 people on site when the building collapsed. Six people have now been confirmed deceased. So we are still looking for 48 survivors. Rescue workers are communicating with people in three pockets beneath the rubble at this stage, and that's the focus areas for the moment.
And voter family members are on the scene, or at least close to the scene, I'm told.
Yes, they've been accommodated in a municipal building close by. It's obviously a very traumatic time and experience for everyone involved. The head of disaster management, Colin Diner, when he gave his briefing this morning, just re-emphasized that they have to work extremely carefully because they do not want to cause material that's unstable at the moment to collapse any further. So it's definitely a rescue mission for the next 3 days. They will continue to treat every missing person as a potential survivor, and they will, the focus is 100% at this stage to try and get as many people out safe and alive as possible.
And what about assistance and capacity? I understand that the aid organization Gift of the Givers is on the scene, but who else is helping you?
Gift on the Givers is on the scene. They're doing sterling work, as always. We've got specialized dogs that are helping to locate people. And then we've got counselors who are assisting family and co-workers with trauma. SAPS is also playing an important role, and then all the various specialized rescue units from all over the province that have sent support to the disaster site.
Let me pick you up on that. I do understand that emergency personnel were dispatched from Cape Town as well as the town of Worcester. Are there plans to bring in more units from other parts of the country?
I cannot confirm whether we're going to go that wide yet, but it was mentioned this morning that the staff on the ground needs to be managed very carefully. People are getting extremely tired. They've been working long hours, so there will be a rotation system to make sure that we do not put the rescue workers under unnecessary risk.
Am I correct in saying, or I did read, that other buildings within the vicinity have also been evacuated for safety precautions?
I cannot confirm that, Jeremy, but it does make sense. There's a lot of movement in and around the terrain with heavy equipment. Once they start removing rubble with cranes, there'll be even more heavy equipment and vehicles. So it does make sense to clear the area and to keep the public safe as well.
And just finally, it's obviously too soon to determine the cause unless you can fill me in otherwise. How is this going to be investigated and when does that start?
So the investigation already started. It's being treated as a crime scene. SAPS has already been on the scene, and we've appointed a team of independent engineers to do a study, because we need to know what happened and why it happened, so that lessons can be learned for the future. But that's definitely a big secondary focus at the moment. For now, we are racing against the clock to try and get as many people out as possible.
All right, thank you very much indeed. Wouter Kriel, who speaks for Anton Bredell, who is the Western Cape Minister of Local Government, Environmental Affairs and Development Planning. As you heard there, the death toll has now risen to six.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The South African Post Office's bid for relief from the Temporary Employer Employee Relief Scheme, we know it better as TERS, has failed. What does that mean? Well, it puts mass job cuts at the state entity back on the table. Joining us now is Mondli Gungubeli, who is the Minister of Communications and Digital Technology. And Minister, first of all, then, what immediate measures is your ministry taking to mitigate the severe impact on workers and their families?
It's quite an upsetting outcome. We thought, Jeremy, those workers, especially during this era of high unemployment, you know the number, if you retrench 4,700, you know the number of the family members that are affected. So we thought we were trying our best, but for whatever reason, TERS felt that certain requirements are not being met. But we have not given up because we still believe, even if these workers are retrenched, there must be a way of retraining them, either making them useful for the future viable post office. We're even discussing with some of the postal service delivery outlets, which are of independent companies, to check if they cannot take those. So we are reapplying to other institutions. We may even approach even the PIC, but the issue now is, how do you retrain them? How do you make them viable in the modern postal service delivery methodology that the post office found itself wanting on?
Minister, that's one issue. Of course, the other is the rejection of this funding does suggest deeper ongoing systemic issues within the post office. And it begs the question then, are there long-term strategies that are being developed to ensure the viability of this entity? Or are you reaching the point now where you're going to give up?
No. Giving up is not an option, Jeremy. Remember, when we were applying, remember there are two possibilities. There were two possibilities that the post office was confronted with. For instance, remember I came in around March last year. I was confronted by an attempt to liquidate it. You know, liquidation would have meant that it does not exist. Not a single worker is still at work, not even a service is still being delivered. So the other one was business rescue, which required particular conditions. One, that we have a turnaround plan. Two, during the period of rescue, will we still be offering some service? Three, are we able to service creditors to some degree? When all those requirements were met, will there be funding? And then government committed to add funding over and above 2.4 billion, funding of about 3.8 billion. And then on the basis of that, the judge granted us an opportunity of rescuing the post office. But now, for that three, they are already using the 2.4 billion. And I want us to commend these young rescuers, because they came in July. By December, they were able to table before creditors an acceptable what-to-call plan. It might have its imperfections, but we believe that they are capable of improving it, because what the Minister of Finance wants, before considering 3.8 billion funding to them, they need to table before the Minister of Finance that indeed this 3 billion will be used in areas where you will put the post office on the path that it will ensure that it's not derailed again.
Minister, there are reports today which say that post office workers who are facing retrenchment are simply not interested in getting their jobs back or want to be reskilled. They simply want to be paid out. The problem, of course, is you can't afford it, can you?
No. The business rescuers, Jeremy, had long negotiations in terms of Section 189. They did agree on the forms of payment. For instance, they said they will pay them in three tranches over 8 months. Those issues are agreed. But our big challenge is, where are these workers going to end, and how their families are going to be affected?
So at what point then do you start aggressively implementing and convincing people that the turnaround plan for the post office is actually going to work and will provide some sort of sustainable guarantee to those workers and their families?
I mean, when you say to the workers and their family, I'm sure you're referring to those who have escaped retrenchment.
Yes.
Now, as I'm talking to you now, we are dealing with this election campaign. We're also working on those issues. We know the business rescuers are working on a plan that they are going to table before me and the Minister of Finance, a more viable plan. And we are convinced they will do it. We hope to get that maybe after the end of May. We'll be happy if we get it before the end of May. But we hope to consider and deal with that after the end of May. But we are also on them. If that plan is there before the end of May, the Minister of Finance, because what we're also doing, Jeremy, I must also make this point. You remember the old post office crisis occurred during the phase of the fiscal challenges for government. We are also looking, if this 3.8 billion, if there are other alternatives that would save a portion of this 3.8 billion, we're also looking at that. We're not saying at all costs it must be 3.8 billion that is used. So we expect them to present that. We would have got that plan some weeks ago, but we're allowing them, because they were defocused, to attend to this tiers, what to call issue, which didn't work. So we expect them now to tighten the plan so that they can qualify to actually get that 3.8 billion.
And Minister, just a final question then. At some point, you're going to have to reevaluate both the leadership of the post office or the operational model in order to guarantee survival. Again, what are you doing in that respect? Are there going to be longer-term changes?
If you look at the business rescue plan, it speaks about how the operations went wrong, how they got costly, the turnaround to deal with those, both at the strategic level, at the operational level, and at the same time, the infrastructure that is old, which is not modernized for the current situation. Remember, Jeremy, postal services is an international phenomenon for the people who are in far-flung areas and people who are poor. Without it, it's not going to be easy to make sure that they enjoy the right to communicate like other people. So, indeed, there's an operational intervention, there's a strategic intervention, there's also infrastructure intervention, too, and also issues of partnership, Jeremy.
I am going to leave it there, Minister Mondli Gungubele. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Overnight, a statement from the Department of International Relations says it is deeply disturbed about the unfolding developments in Gaza and is horrified by the Israeli military's announcement that Rafah should be evacuated immediately, as it will be operating in an area of what it terms extreme force. The Director General for the department is Zain Dangor and joins me now on the program. DG, good afternoon to you and welcome. Are there any new diplomatic steps then that South Africa is planning as a result of this?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. When we saw the initial plans to invade Russia, was Rafah was in January already. So that's why I asked the ICJ for additional provisional orders. And the response was that the orders that they gave in January were sufficient to ensure that Israel does not, engage in any ground offensive in Rafah. But we are now concerned that those provisional orders are ignored, and those of the provisional orders of March and the Security Council resolution is being ignored. We have asked our mission in New York to immediately ask for an emergency session of the Security Council so that the Security Council does actually pass a resolution that is binding, preventing Israel from actually engaging with the kind of force in Rafah that will see mass deaths. There's nowhere for people to go. The evacuation order says go to Khan Yunis. We know that Khan Yunis is already an area where people are being bombed. We've also seen the past experience where the so-called safe routes, as soon as people get onto those safe routes, they are being bombed. So our duty in terms of preventing genocide, which is also a part of our duty in terms of Article 1, is to alert the international community to this, to alert Israel's allies that are very close to them to ensure that they put pressure on Israel not to actually use the force that they're threatening to do in Rafah. We've seen overnight, for example, bombing of tents and also villages. But as soon as those tanks go over that sort of red line that Egypt is called, we're going to see mass deaths. So we are using all the tools available to us to try and prevent this.
The problem, of course, DG, is that those tools are very blunt, because your entire focus is predicated on Israel acceding to any pressure that comes from the international community. And we know that hasn't happened in the past.
Well, that's the issue that we want to engage with, because this level of institutionalized impunity has given rise to Israel believing that they can get away with things and their backs literally will be held by their allies. But we actually seeing a little bit of a change in tone from the US, and we're hoping that change in tone will result in overt pressure for Israel to stop. Unfortunately, in this space, it's about those who provide you with material support can either allow this to continue or they can act to stop it.
And of course, tentative suggestions at the weekend about possible negotiations, but that does seem a long way off.
Yeah, so when we engaged with the Qataris about a week ago, they did indicate that in all likelihood that one party to these negotiations will accept the ceasefire, but they were doubtful about whether the Israeli side would accept it. But we hope that they'll come through and accept it, because a ceasefire and a permanent ceasefire is important. So that will allow talks to continue.
What do you think, and I know that you're not in the business of speculation when it comes to the diplomatic game, but what do you think the end game is here?
Look, when we, before October 7th, when we visited Israel and Palestine in January, we spoke to a number of diplomats, former Israeli diplomats as well, including the former head of the Foreign Affairs Division. There was always a sense that the end game was to depopulate Gaza. And this is now, we've seen this happening, not just through forced migration, but also through the kinds of depletion of all the means to sustain a livelihood. We're seeing a new form of international crime emerging, which has been called domicide, which is the destruction of homes and the means to just live sustainably. In this sense, that in much of Gaza, it's going to take up to 50 years to rebuild some of it. So we can see that there's a long-term plan to depopulate Gaza. What we want to prevent is not just the depopulation, but the mass deaths that's occurring with that. So that's the end game we know from the Israeli side, and I have to be blunt about it. And that's why we've been engaging with the US, the EU, and using the tools of global governance, such as the ICJ and the ICC, for individual criminal liability to stop that. Because the normal practices of diplomacy in this instance has not worked for over 5 decades.
Zain Dangor, thank you very much indeed, Director General at the Department of International Relations.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A former lecturer at the Western TVET College in Krugersdorp, east of Johannesburg, has failed to set aside her dismissal after she had posted pictures of herself and her colleague at the airport on the day that she was supposedly not fit for work due to what she claimed was a medical condition. I want to explore this in a little bit more detail now with labour lawyer Patrick Deal. So Patrick, first of all, on what legal grounds can an employer dismiss an employee for misconduct relating to, as we've seen, falsely claiming medical leave?
Well, the ground is dishonesty, first of all, and it's unfortunately very common. And insofar as the first point is concerned, dishonesty is that if you are submitting anything to your employer, making a claim for something like sick leave, and you need to produce, in this example, a medical aid certificate, the employer is entitled to rely on it as being valid. And if it suspects that it's not valid, it can check up on it. But in this case, if it accepts it as valid, grants the leave for which the person is being paid, then discovers, because the person is seen on TV or on Facebook or on other social media connections as being perfectly well and frolicking around outside of work and not sick, that is clear case of a fraudulent medical certificate. So it's a combination of fraud and dishonesty. And the point about that is the employment relationship is based, underpinned by honesty. Mm. And if this happens, then the employer simply can't trust the employee anymore. And that's gross misconduct. And it's clearly a dismissible offense and misconduct.
Patrick, does social media construe sufficient evidence?
Absolutely. It's really what the message conveys. Social media is just an additional new one, well, relatively new, sort of 15 years or so, manner in which conveying information. And it is a clear form of evidential information in the same way that a document is evidence in a trial, in any court proceedings or any disciplinary proceedings. Any verbal evidence is available for people to determine whether facts are true or not. So too are entries on social media, whether it's Facebook, WhatsApp, or whatever. And it is evidence that people have said something and can be used in making a case to prove, in this case, fraud, a fraudulent medical certificate, and dishonesty, which is serious misconduct.
Patrick, is there any intersection between privacy law and an employer's right to scrutinize an employee's social media activity if ultimately, as in this case, it's going to lead to disciplinary action?
It doesn't come into this situation simply because this is published. And once it's been published, you know, on social media, the protection against privacy is taken away. So it doesn't help an employee to try and rely on Poppy or anything else in these circumstances, because once it's published, it's published. It becomes public. It's no longer private. And so there's no protection at all in those circumstances.
We've got to the point now where surely an employee could cry, deep fake, that's not me. Does that not put added onus on the employer to do more due diligence in scrutinizing the social media post?
I think the first answer is that the onus would shift to the employee in that case to prove that it is not what it appears to be, because the employer is entitled to take it at face value. And effectively, if the employee says it's fake or it's AI generated, I didn't generate it, someone else has done it to set me up or frame me or something like that, the onus shifts to the employee to prove that as a defense. So the evidential obligation shifts to the employee in those circumstances to prove the allegation, which the employer hasn't made the allegation. The employee makes the allegation. So that's why the employee then has to prove it in those circumstances.
Does the employee have any rights at all when it comes to defending themselves against allegations based on their social media activity? In other words, not only that, but also right of appeal.
Well, in the first case, they do have rights to defend themselves in the same way as they are able to defend themselves against any other kind of evidence. Social media postings are simply, as I mentioned earlier, one form of evidence that gets stacked up into the scales of justice to determine whether an employer has proved its case or not. And so it has a right to, test whether it's credible, whether it is theirs, and what weight it should be attached in the scales of evidence piling up, either for the employer or for the employee, depending on which then sways the decision-making process. And if the employer says, no, this is, in this case, a fake medical certificate, and the employee says, no, it was an AI-generated, or it's fake, or something along those lines, they can appeal, but they can only appeal on limited grounds based on whatever wrong decision has been made in the original disciplinary inquiry. So they can appeal internally, and if the appeal is overridden, and if the employer says, no, we're sticking by what we said in the disciplinary inquiry, we do think that it was fraudulent and it's not fake, and therefore we're going to hold it to you as dishonest, we're going to confirm the dismissal. So the employee in that situation can then, in a sense, appeal to the CCMA and go further, and then have another go in the CCMA to see if a commissioner or an arbitrator at the CCMA can come up with a different verdict based essentially on the same evidence. And then the commissioner's got to say, look at the evidence, listen to the version of the employee, listen to the version of the employer, and say, well, who's right and who's wrong, and weigh it up and say, do I find in favor of the employer or the employee? So that, and then it's another sort of sense of appeal. Mm. Of course, then it can go higher up, of course, to the labor court and so on. It can go up quite a few levels of appeal.
Patrick Deal, I am going to leave it there. As always, thank you very much for joining me on MoneyWeb at Midday.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally, Cape Town's growing cafe culture has earned it global recognition as one of the world's top cities for coffee. That's according to the prestigious US culinary magazine Food and Wine. Enver Dumini is the Chief Executive Officer of Cape Town Tourism. He joins me on the program now. And firstly then, how do you anticipate this inclusion is going to impact the industry and, I guess, tourism in general?
So, Jeremy, South Africa and Cape Town has sometimes been in the media for the wrong reasons. And I think these accolades and acknowledgement by independent global institutions like the US Food and Wine, recognizing Cape Town as one of the top 10 destinations for coffee and coffee culture, definitely goes a long way in, again, creating more positive news about the destination. And coffee is ingrained in kind of our culture in South Africa. Who doesn't wake up having the cup of coffee, another one before you go and sleep, even though you know you shouldn't? We have so many cups of coffee during the day, but it's also become part of the social fabric of the city. There is no meeting that happens without a cup of coffee. There is no engagement where we're even socializing without a cup of coffee. And I think, again, this is the beauty of why we've been recognized, because it's part of the fabric and the fibers of our city. And it's also a great way for us to elicit conversation, to unpack storytelling. So coffee is this amazing connector that is not just about the beans and the aroma and kind of the geeks that love those kind of things, but it's almost like, a bit of comfort in a cup. And I think that's the beauty of this recognition and what it means for our city. But I think also what does add to it is that the opportunity to showcase some of the amazing coffee houses, the roasters and companies. And one of my favorites, at least there's two, besides Truth Roastery, which is probably one of our most famous ones that sits with, I think, a roaster that goes back to 1947. There are some amazing ones. For example, I Love Coffee Group, that was established in 2016, run by the deaf community. It's an amazing space where the artisans, everybody employed, is either has hearing impairment or is deaf. And what I love about the space is that they even teach you how to sign for your different types of your order. You know, I love the my favorite is always the cold milk, where you kind of have to shiver a little bit, and then almost like you milking a cow,
as an
expression. And I think that's the beauty of how coffee and coffee culture actually is universal and inclusive and accessible.
So let me suggest to you then, after this accolade, the ball is kind of in Cape Town Tourism's court now, because it will be incumbent upon you to provide more assistance, I guess, to local coffee shops and roasters to help them sustain and thrive. Do you have plans?
No, absolutely. I think, again, the beauty of tourism is that people want to hang out, or tourists want to hang out where the locals hang out. And what we're finding is what they call out of home, is where people are not necessarily, you still have a cup of coffee at home, but most of the times they'll have it out of home. So we'll go to coffee shops, they'll connect, they'll have meetings there. We see with the remote working, people are setting up offices in coffee shops, around coffee shops. So what we do is we continue to highlight all these coffee shops, where they can be found, what makes them unique, even the fact that we've got special blends like red cappuccino, rooibos infused. These are unique, again, to the destination, and the tourists love this. So as Cape Town Tourism, we'll continue to promote not just the Truths or the I Love Coffee groups, but even Siki's Coffee in Khayelitsha, one of the best blenders that you'll ever find. And that's the beauty of working with Cape Town Tourism. And our role is, of course, to shine a spotlight on all the amazing experiences, including coffee.
There is a growing global emphasis, is there not, on sustainability. Do you think that the coffee business in the city is taking enough cognizance of this to ensure that their operations are environmentally friendly and sustainable, Enver?
That's a very good question, Jeremy. I think to some degree, yes, they are. But of course, we can always do better, and we've got probably a long way to go. One of the critical elements we always look at is around fair trade and making sure there's a fair trade mark in how where the coffee beans are sourced, how it's produced, making sure that it's inclusive as well. And if I can give a good example is the I Love Coffee group shows you how fair trade and how inclusive coffee can be. But again, it is a long way to go. It's where we source it from. It's critically important. And even last night, I saw on the news, there's a young lady in Limpopo who started her own farm in coffee. And it's a very small holding. I think she's got 1 hectare. But she's beginning to now actually grow coffee beans, which is, I think, is an exciting opportunity, again, of how we can use fair trade, and maybe the coffee shops in and around South Africa can start sourcing from her and helping her to grow her business.
Have you got to the point where you might have started crunching numbers to see what the coffee industry is actually worth to the city?
Unfortunately not, Jeremy. Maybe that's something we can look into in working with the coffee shops and seeing if they can provide us with that information. But I know that in the U.S., I think it was valued at about $98 billion in 2023. I think they got about 40,000 stores in the U.S. And I was also informed that I think China's actually surpassed the U.S. as far as the number of coffee shops and stores compared to the U.S. So it's definitely a global culture. And if those numbers are anything to go by and we are in the top 10, I think we can definitely look at what that opportunity is to grow that across not only Cape Town, but I think South Africa as well.
Well, it certainly is a wonderful accolade. Enver Dumini, Chief Executive Officer, Cape Town Tourism, appreciate the call. Thanks very much. And just before we leave you, on our last online poll, we spoke about South Africa's cannabis economy, and I asked you if it had huge potential, if there was risk attached, or if regulation was critical. Over half our respondents saying the business has huge upside. Today, Shell's decision to scale back. My question to you, inevitable, a jobs disaster, or more disinvestment ahead? If you have a view on that, please share it with me. Go to MoneyWeb on Twitter, X, or our LinkedIn page, and I'll bring you the results on the program tomorrow. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.